So years ago, when I first started to practice, Rodney Smith, you know, my teacher, the founder of SIMS, really emphasized death and dying as a spiritual practice, because you know certainly that's what brought him back from being a monk, is to really investigate this quality of his own mortality and to use it as a spiritual awakening, you know, as a way to really bring that energy. And so through his teaching and also doing work with hospice, work with, you know, just investigating my own death and dying, I just found it was a very helpful practice to start to wake up to this reality that we all will die at some point. And everyone that we love, everyone that we care about will also die. When we first take that, you know, when we first start to get through our denial of that, and start to really take it into our cells and our bones. And of course, there can be naturally fear arise. There can be a sense of despair. You know, if we've suffered losses, those also arise to the moment. And so that's all part of this process. And we have to kind of find our own way with how much we go into this topic and how quickly we go into it. Because ideally what it's meant to do is to bring a quality of urgency and also wakefulness to practice. Death and dying, you know, the sense of release, that deep release, is really in contrast to how we usually live our lives. You know, usually we live our lives with a sense of never-ending tomorrows, that there'll always be the next chance, the next thing to do. Remember when my grandfather was dying, he was sending some letters to me, and he said that we're kind of running out of, I'll get around to it. You know, there's not enough time. There's time is trying to, you could see that wasn't continuing on the way it normally would. So this is one of the things that death starts to teach us, is our relationship to time. You know, I think each one of us, we have idea what tomorrow will bring and hopes for what the next year and the years coming forth will bring. But that's all a projection to the future. Right? We start to bring the reality that we will die at some point, and we don't know when that day will be. Even if we're struggling with a terminal illness right now, we don't know when that day will be. It allows us to drop time in a way that very few other things can. And when we drop time, what arises forth is the immensity of this moment, of how this moment is. And if we're able to kind of navigate through our normal, you know, the fear around our mortality and the overwhelm and the despair, to actually relax into that timeless. That's one of the gifts of working with death and dying. In fact, if we look at it from, I remember going up to a retreat up in Vancouver that Rodney was holding on death and dying, investigating death and dying. And he kept emphasizing that stillness that's here in this moment and how that is a form of death, is a form of letting go, a form of release. And starting to orient to that way of looking at it, they can see how each moment is actually dying. It is when we start to cling to that, when we try to hold to that moment to be a certain way and to last a certain duration, that's when we're in that process of suffering, that process of struggle. And yet, any moment, we can just relax into the timeless, relax into the depth of this present moment and see what is here. You know, death also teaches us the release of our roles, our identity. I think Tweri talked about impermanence as a gateway into death. And this is one of those things that we can kind of take on intellectually, that, yeah, I understand things change, the seasons change, and that, this and that. But when we start to actually realize that the things we hold very dear, the very ways we orient and define ourselves also change, are also impermanent. This is also a gift from death. because that's, of course, the ultimate release of all our identity, all our anything that we claim is I, me, and mine. That can't pass through. What did Jesus talk about? The eye of the needle can't pass through that. There can't be that sense of bringing anything with us as we go through that transition, through that ending. So that sense of impermanence and that releasing those things that we hold dear, again, we can go into, we have to really balance how much, it's maybe like a carburetor, how much fuel and air we put into the mix. We don't want things to be so hot that we're becoming overwhelmed and depressed and anxious. But that is that right amount where we start to feel that sense of urgency, that sense of wakefulness. Last month, I just used death and dying as a practice in addiction, and how we can kind of look at, contemplate our own death and know, maybe I have a year to live. Maybe I have 6 months. Maybe I have a month or a week or a few days or a day or an hour, a minute. And you can see what time frame is the right time frame to kind of hold it as a practice. Now, if it's too close, perhaps there's that overwhelm. Or maybe if it's too close, you just say, well, okay, there's nothing I can do other than surrender to it. If it's too far away, like 10 years, then maybe I can just kind of postpone. So I encourage you to kind of play with that. Okay, let's say I only had a year to live, as Stephen Levine's book, you know, takes that practice on. So going back to that, the sense of the impermanence, okay, that sense of what do I hold dear, that too will pass. That too will end. And the more we can bring that into this very moment, we see that each thought, each sensation, each mind state, each sense of identity, a sense of me-ness, of I-ness, of you-ness, also arises and passes away. In some ways, when we talk about impermanence, we often notice the arising. When we contemplate death and dying, we can start to really notice the dissipating, the fading away, the releasing of experience of identity. And I think we can reflect on our own lives and the different stages that we've gone through. Or perhaps you when you went to school and you ended going to school, when you had your first job and that job ended, when you first had a child, and then when that child went into adulthood. And there's all these transitions when we go to retirement. There's these senses of identity that have to shift. And there's these big shifts that catch our attention, big shifts of impermanence. But if we look closely, that actually is happening, you know, in a microscopic way. And holding death as a contemplation, as an inquiry, allows us to start to see there's actually a something that is surprisingly wonderful that happens when we hold that, instead of the panic and the despair of the fact that everything's changing and everything's ending. We start to participate in the flow of life versus trying to hold that flow back. So this is another gift, is we start to become in harmony with impermanence, with the fact that things are always in flux, always changing, and death and dying brings a little bit more energy, or a lot more energy, to seeing that, to experiencing that. So we have impermanence. We have a sense of timelessness. And then I think finally I'll just talk about the quality of, sorry, I got distracted with business here. Just the Zoom tech support stuff. The final one I want to talk about is that sense of what's trivial. You know, when I look back on this day I just lived, you know, I can think about all the things I did. You know, some stuff was necessary, was needed to do. Other stuff was more for entertainment or for distraction. We start to contemplate death and dying. That brings a level of perspective, you know, perspective that, okay, is this really how I want to use this preciousness of time, this preciousness of this life, how finite or long it might be. As I like to mention the Carlos Castaneda using death as an advisor, you know, when you find yourself struggling with, should I do this or not, or that sense of engagement, imagining that death is just off your left shoulder about ready to tap you, and how that, just that, looking at that, contemplating that, it's like, oh, maybe I will choose to be kind in this moment. Maybe I'll choose to actually pay attention and not be distracted to my 2-year-old telling me the endless story that they might be telling. I might take the time to actually experience the play of the light on the tree branch or on the sky. So death and dying, you know, allows us to start to drop some of the that engagement, that sense of clinging, that sense of really attachment to things which perhaps are not so important in the end. And reflecting that our deaths will end. Our lives will end, I should say. So these aspects of the timeless, that death brings that quality of releasing of time in a very profound way. That there is no tomorrows when we hold the fact that we're dying. And to bring that right into this moment, how this moment itself, we relax into it, there is the timeless. And the mystery of what happens after we die, it is a mystery. You know, no one knows for sure what happens. Many theories, many ideas, certainly Buddhism has many of those. I like to practice just with that releasing of the future, releasing of the past. Okay, what's right here, right now? What's actually present? Allowing myself to surrender as deeply as I can to that quality of stillness, that quality of the timeless. Quality of impermanence. And impermanence arises. You know, we see, again, we deny that, and death and dying allows us to see through that illusion. And actually relax into it, to actually delight in the fact that things are constantly arising and passing away. We may see a small death, and then we see the small birth. And then, you know, finally, the sense of releasing the what is unimportant, which is trivial, what is distracting, to bring to forefront, you know, the urgency. I think if I knew I only had, let's say, a few months to live, I would certainly reprioritize things in a very profound way. I think it's often reflect that when I talk to people who've had cancer diagnoses that they recovered from, or scares even, and how if we had that every 10 years, it would kind of really benefit us. Those kind of false diagnoses, but enough urgency, enough reality in it that we would kind of reorder our life. Get our lives in order, but also commit to living life in a more deep, full way. And finally, I like to just share that the Buddha often talked about the deathless. He talked about the deathless. And that is not about a sense of immortality, but more about what isn't subject to arising and passing away, what is not conditioned, what is not subject to dukkha, to impermanence, what's not subject to self. And if you start to orient yourself in this way to the teachings and see that, you that's really the gift of what we've been talking about this evening, is the sense of the timeless, the sense of the mystery arising, the releasing into the beautiful delight of life arising and passing away, and the perspective to release what is not so important, not so vital for our well-being, for our lives. All right, I think that's enough on that for me today. So we can just sit quietly for a few moments. All right, so I'd like to have us do some breakout rooms and some small group discussions. And before everybody runs away, if you like to not do those, you're welcome to stay back here and then come back to the larger group discussion in about 20 minutes. For those who like, the topic will be, I'm going to use what Tori had planned tonight, which was, how important is understanding death or impermanence to you? How central is it in your practice? Let me put that in the chat, actually. How important is understanding death or impermanence to you? How central is it to your practice? All right, so let's put you in terms of I think 4 is probably a good number. So you get an invitation to join those groups. And for 20 minutes, you can just share your experience around this. These groups aren't about offering suggestions or advice, but really deeply listening to each other and deeply sharing. All right, welcome back, everyone. Looks like that was a good discussion based on judging by how long it took you to come back after the meeting. The invitation was closed, so that's a good sign. All right, so we have a chance for any sharing, comments, questions you might have about this topic, you know, how central is impermanence and death to your practice, to your life? Or we could also explore anything else you'd like to share. So you're welcome to either just unmute yourself or you could raise your virtual hand. I likely won't see your physical hand, so use the virtual or the unmuting. Okay, Albert.
In our group, we talked about incorporating death more into our practice, our contemplative practice, but we also discussed ways to become actively involved with being with others around this issue and maybe also in a helpful way. And we were wondering if you had thoughts and or comments or suggestions along those lines.
So how to engage more directly with people who are actually going through death and dying?
Right. Yes.
Well, there's a group at SIMS. There's a SIMS death and dying group. And they're actually one of their missions is to support Sangha members who are going through that transition. And they also meet regularly and talk about, you know, what that brings up and what that holds as a practice. So I would certainly suggest that. I believe that's on the website. You can take, you know, search for that. If you have trouble finding it, you can send us, you know, email to SIMS, to the SIMS at board, and we can connect you with Tracy, who leads that group. Certainly hospice volunteering can be a wonderful way to, it's a very important need. You have to go through some training, but it's a way to help you to really engage with that. And then I think Tori will talk, she said that when I talked to her on the phone about this class this evening, that she's going to bring practices much more in to next week's talk. And so I think that'll be another good way to do it. But even just simply when you're out, you know, walking and you see, you know, an animal that's been hit by a car, or, you know, you see I was mowing the grass and found, you know, saw a robin's egg that had been shattered. So probably a crow had, you know, picked it apart. And, you know, often we just kind of glance over that, or maybe we're disgusted by that, but just pausing and just taking that in that, you know, this too could be me, you know, this too is my destination. It may look very differently, but the end result is the same. And just kind of having those reminders come in. Because, you know, life, I mean, the world is full of things dying. You know, you hear something on the news about someone who's been, you know, killed or died or an accident, you know, pausing, maybe even turning off that or stopping, you know, browsing and just take that in. Like, oh, this person has died and there's people grieving for their loss and how, you know, how I've grieved. So just start to, you know, gently bring that into the forefront, start to bring a quality of, you know, gentle interest around it. I think those can be very helpful. And I remember that first suggestion of the roadkill. I was actually teaching at IMS and there was a dead animal on this. There's a 3-mile loop. Those of you have been there. And I walked, you know, I was there for for 7 days. And each day I walked and saw that slow decomposing, you know, how the bones become more and more exposed. And it's like that sense of impermanence, taking that in. Sorry, you unmuted yourself, Albert. Do you have a follow-up on that?
I meant to mute myself, but thank you. Yeah, I'm going to look into the Sangha and other things, being a little bit more mindful of it. So thank you.
You're welcome.
Tim, may I offer two more suggestions? Harborview Hospital has a program called No One Dies Alone. And that's also a program where you go through some training and can sit with someone who doesn't have any family or someone close. And I don't know if it's been suspended during the pandemic. And then another one is to start having conversations with your loved ones about your own death and see what happens in those conversations. They can really be powerful. So that would be another. And the Death and Dying Project is, it's not an open drop-in session, but if you reach out to Tracy and get to know her, and she finds out, you know, what you're interested in, then you'll get an invitation.
Thank you, Suze.
You're welcome.
Yeah, Suze has been involved with this topic for many years and many different levels, both very personal and caring for many people. I saw a chat that program she mentioned looks like it's closed to COVID. You know, I think you can get on their list. So when they reopen, I'm sure they'll have a need. All right. So what else is out there?
Tim.
Hi, Iris. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you. you know, our group reflected on the point you made in contemplating death and impermanence regarding bringing to the fore the importance of paying attention to being alive and to being present. And the sort of inherent beauty and sort of intimacy with being present in the moment, it's enlivened by contemplations of experiencing impermanence and contemplations about death. So thank you for your teaching tonight.
You're welcome. I think there's, just off the top of my head, there's the kind of the two prongs of death and dying investigation, or as a Dharma practice. You know, one is that kind of sobering quality, that it kind of wakes us up to our illusion, our delusion. But the other part is what you spoke about, is the sense of aliveness, the sense of wakefulness, the sense of presence that then arises from holding that topic. Yeah, so thank you for sharing that, Iris. Okay, Carla.
Yeah, as we were speaking, I also started to think about that two-pronged effect of contemplating death. I had an experience a couple years ago of someone I was quite close to, a friend, dying. And I actually had the opportunity to receive support from the Sims Death and Dying group. So if anyone is in a similar position, I really recommend speaking to them. It was a really meaningful experience, both for me and the person who was dying. It was very supportive. Anyway, at the time, this person was ill for a number of months and was in hospice for a number of months. So there was sort of a prolonged phase of knowing he was approaching death, but still being able to be together. And I did experience that in many ways is a very alive time for me. And there was so much clarity. Knowing my friend is dying, it was just, you know, it was suddenly so easy to know what was most important in life at that time, and that there was absolutely no doubt that I would choose, you know, like to drive to the hospital that day and visit him, and I didn't even have to consider doing something else. And that clarity and, you know, the depth of connection we had because I was able to be with him during that time was felt very, very alive. But I'm noticing that when I think about my own death, it feels different. So the sense of more sadness and the realization, you know, that that time is so limited. Even when I think about, you know, what would I do if I only had a week or a month? How would I spend that time? My mind goes more towards, I find it more almost overwhelming. It's like, how can I make that decision? You know, if I knew that, how would I choose who to see and who not to see? And suddenly it feels like no choice would be meaningful. It would be kind of arbitrary. So I just noticed that I have a very different set of thoughts and emotions come up when I relate to someone else who's dying and when I think about my own death.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. That was very articulate about that. I think that's a common thing that we notice, that, you know, we can be very compassionate and connected with someone else's death, but when it comes to our own, they're a whole different. It's very much more personal. I remember Rodney talking about when he was a hospice director, a hospice nurse, you know, who works with, you know, death and dying every day. When she had a lump show up, it was a whole different thing for her. You know, she thought she would be prepared, but that personalness of it took, you know, just a whole different way. And I think it's helpful to reflect on those stages of grief, you know, that when we really are facing our mortality, whether it's a diagnosis or just this contemplation. I mean, we naturally go through denial. We go through bargaining. We go through anger, you know, fear, sadness, and acceptance. You know, I gave you more than five, but, you know, they kind of all churn around. And so being very patient with that process and realizing that's part of it, that the mind has to really accommodate to that fact. And it's okay to feel that sense of confusion, that sense of I'm not sure what I would do, or nothing seems profound enough. And that's where this kind of a practice has its own form of a koan or like a Zen riddle. That it's like we can't solve it through our normal way of thinking about things. A normal perspective, you know, has these basic things that, okay, I'm going to basically live forever, that everyone else is going to die, but not me. I mean, that's somewhat of a perspective that we go through. And the Zen riddle, the koan is, okay, how do I work with that? And the confusion is part of that. The confusion actually shows you that there is something. Once you see through that, there's a richness to it. And to realize that it changes, you know, one day you may feel like, you know, I'm completely at peace with it. And the next day you're completely freaked out and terrified by it. And that's part of being human. Yeah. So thank you for sharing that, Carla.
Thank you, Tim.
All right, who else would like to share anything? Okay, Lori.
Close enough, maybe. Well, no, it's too dark at this point, but well, a couple of things, and thank you, Tim, for stepping in. In our small group, it was so powerful. One, this importance of the impermanence and death, and just like, and the second piece was just how you stepped in, you know, very short notice, stepping in tonight and pulling together what you shared for me came from this place where you feel a deep ease, I am guessing, from this topic and all of the cultivation and the work you've done around this. And how this fits together is that you know, I've brushed deaths too many times or enough times that I recognize that in my daily sitting, old memories have actually subconsciously come up. And an anxiety that I hadn't realized was actually this memory, this terror, and you know, through the good fortune of being in having support facilities, the medications, and to turn things around, it's like I know very acutely I'm on borrowed time, but I hadn't recognized until tonight that some of this anxiety coming up is old visceral experience of this letting go and feeling the dying, feeling this happening, and the right drugs and stuff and people's support coming back. And that connected to you stepping in with this ease. And you didn't have control over Tawari having, you know, and the family thing, having to step out, but your depth of internal ease and comfort with this topic, you could step in. And that's inspired me to moving forward to really aspire for this inner ease and comfort so that if death comes and I don't have the supports or don't have the things that I'd like externally, I will have it internally. Mm-hmm. Just as you stepped in tonight with this ease and this grace and this comfort, I would like that too when my death experience comes. So thank you.
You're welcome, Lori. Thank you for sharing so vulnerably. And I think that I appreciate what your reflection, and you know, sometimes when I teach something that, you know, I try to teach from what I know from my own experience. So there's that ground that's easy to come from. And, you know, working with, you know, our own, I know that the difficulties you've had, you know, personally, it's a very different level, you know, and I think it's important to also just to realize that as human beings, we often need multiple facets in how we approach something. And not to have this ideal how we think we should be around death, because it is a very personal thing. It's an arising thing. And we don't know how we will be in that, because it can bring forth such terror, and also such, you know, it has the potential for that peace and that wakefulness. It's this whole, you know, whole catastrophe, this whole spectrum. And sometimes, you know, like when you have that sense of old memories coming up from those close rushes, you know, working with that area, how can I release that trauma that has built up around that might be a helpful way to practice with it as well. Because that physiological shift, when you start to really get that physiological fear happening, it really takes forefront. So practicing with that, and as well as having that sense of how can I have that ease, that grace with whatever is arising, that sense of not, you know, not having any agenda. So thank you, Lori. All right, see, Jean has his hand up.
Well, I may sound sort of like a repeat here, because I was duly impressed with your willingness and ability to just step in without announcement. If they had called on me, something would have happened to the computer. It would have broken. I would have disappeared. So thank you, Tim. I'm really grateful for the, this may seem odd timing, but I'm really grateful for the experience of Sims. I had a friend who said, oh, it sounds like you're ready for meditation. Why don't you try this group and then try this group? And one of them was Sims, and I made the decision, and I have felt carried and helped ever since that decision was made. And this was yet another example of how the Sangha is carried. And I'm really impressed with the wisdom that comes from people's hearts and minds. And I wanted to say that for those who might be interested in participating in the support of a person who's dying through Sims, I have participated in a group like that, and it has rewards beyond description, because you learn the depth of care and concern that your Sangha members, your fellow members have, and what they carry and what they share. So if you ever have a chance, you'll never regret it. So thank you, Jeff. It's more sharing than insight.
You're very welcome, Gene. Thank you for sharing that also. That working with you have it's a precious gift to be able to work with someone and be with someone who's dying. And it does change us if we really let it in. And it is something that, like how you said, that you won't regret it. All right, thank you, Gene. All right, I saw two hands pop up at the same time. I had Sean and Bruce and Bob. Let's go with Sean first, and Sean and Bruce, just because that's higher for some reason.
Hi, this is Sean. So I'm glad that we're talking about this part here, things that the last two people have brought up, because one of the fears that I have, probably the biggest fear I have around dying, is dying alone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, COVID really brought that to the forefront, especially in the beginning of COVID when there were so many people in the hospitals and dying and their loved ones couldn't come and be with them. And I'm working with that. And, you know, I don't have family. I have my husband, but, you know, he may die before me and I will be alone. And, a lot of my friends have already died, or we're all old and getting older. Mm-hmm. And, I don't want to be afraid to die alone. You know, I want to be able to come into a fuller place inside of myself where there's more trust in the experience that I'm going to have when that happens. And at the same time, I think dying is a community experience. And I'm kind of rambling, but I think the bottom line is I don't want to die alone. I just don't. And it may happen. I mean, I might just die in my sleep and that would be great, you know, but it doesn't usually happen that way.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that, Sean. I think it's, you know, it is a big concern. I think it's a very real concern for those of us who, as we get older and, you know, we're not sure about who's going to be around and, you know, it's that uncertainty. And, you know, so there's the Dharma way of working with it. And there's also the practical way of working with it. And so we have to, you know, use both elements. So the Dharma element is, you know, really opening to preparing the mind and seeing the little deaths and births in each moment, you know, having, you know, all seeing that sense of aliveness, even while we're dying, still be fully alive. And there's the practicalness of it is, you know, how can you find places like what, you know, Sue's talked about, you know, and finding groups that you can kind of prepare, say, if I start to die, I'd like to be able to see if you could, you know, support me in that and connect with me. And luckily, you know, there are many organizations and groups to do that. Probably the primary way is through hospice. You know, hospice is really designed for that and finding ways to help support someone who's going through that transition. And, you know, if you're lucky enough to belong to an organization like SIMS, you can reach out and connect with that. So it's, and there's still the terror of it. There's still the fear of it. So there's the practical and there's also, you know, the Dharma gift. So, and thank you for voicing that. I think it's shared by many people. All right, Bob, would you like to go?
Yeah, my question's kind of similar to Sean's a little bit. One of the things I've been puzzling about in this discussion of death is maybe it's because I'm a teacher, but the question of education, death education, and as Buddhists, how do we in a culture that's so predicated on youth and acquisition and belongings, and how do we arrive at this point where we sort of understand that, okay, that's all this acquiring and being young and stuff isn't going to make me happy. Mm-hmm. How do we educate or share with other people? I'm 67. So you reach a stage where, yeah, okay, I got to start thinking about this a lot more seriously. But somebody who's in their 20s, or our whole culture seems to be focused on other things, and how do you get past the fear dimension of death and also recognize sort of the celebratory dimensions of it? Mm-hmm. I think some other cultures maybe do more than we do, and to where I said something last week about if you can get people to the point where they realize they're not any different than anybody else and they're going to die too, that you can lighten up a little bit, you know? And so anyway, that's my question, is about how do we share this wisdom and not wait till the last minute, you know, to say, oh my God, now I got to deal with it. My relative is dying, or my friend, or, so education is what I'm thinking about, I guess.
Yes, yes, it's a big question because it does bring up the, as you said, the culture is really oriented toward the young and the healthy, and that's kind of the bias. So there's this whole reality, this whole segment of our population that we shut away and we ignore and try to avoid, we deny that, you know, and so it is, there's a mass amount of delusion and denial around it. You know, a couple of thoughts that come to mind, you know, is, you know, going off what you said, Tweri said, about that sense of just seeing the commonality of it. You know, that, you know, if you look on the screen, if you look on gallery view, each of the people you see, including yourself, is going to die someday. And, you know, there's a point where you kind of freak out about it. And there's a point where you say, oh, I'm not alone in this. You know, that, you know, I'm not the only one who's ever going to die. You know, and so I remember doing this exercise with a death year on investigating death and dying, a special class Rodney did. And one of the exercises was to go to a graveyard and look at all the gravestones and reflect on all the tears that were shed for those people. And as I did that, so I was feeling the heaviness around my own mortality and, you know, my loved ones dying. And as I did that, there was a shift from it being personal to being impersonal, but not in a cold, disconnected way, but more of the heart opened so big that it wasn't contained just by my personal pain. It became the pain, the sorrow. And as I, you know, imagine, extrapolated all the graveyards throughout the world and throughout time, it really shifted that biting edge of my own personal pain to see the commonality of it. And then that's a beautiful bridge into it. And I think also just calling attention to it, you know, not being afraid to, you know, I was visiting my mother for Mother's Day. And one of the things we talked about was, you know, how they want to be buried, you know, and just bringing, I mean, they're Dharma practitioners, so it wasn't a big deal, but to bring that up in small ways, in gentle ways, you know, talking about education. I remember in preschool, my daughter, the hamster died. So the teacher took them out into the woods and did a little ceremony. And, you know, when our cat died, you know, we went out and buried the cat and, you know, we said some words about it. And so it brings the quality of, I guess the more unshaking you are with it, that conveys something. I think that's probably the biggest thing. And Rodney would often say that when he was mentoring me as a teacher, when you talk to someone and if you're wavering inside when you're talking about that, they're going to sense that. But there's a sense of ease with connecting with whatever pain they might be feeling, even their own mortality. There's something that relaxes. So that's probably the biggest one, is to be, you know, really do your own work around it so you can convey it with a sense of depth, a sense of wisdom and compassion.
Thanks.
Thank you, Bob. All right. So we're almost at the end of tonight. And I'd like to actually just share a couple short announcements. So one is, Narayan is coming in 2 weeks, a little less than 2 weeks, to offer a weekend retreat. So I highly encourage you to participate and to hear her teaching. She has, you know, she's been practicing for over 35 years and teaching for, you know, 30 of those years. There's a level of depth of joy and love that she really conveys. And she's been a long-term teaching partner for Rodney, and I've been teaching with her for the last 5 years. So I highly recommend that weekend. It's on Zoom, be from 9 to, actually, she's East Coast, so it's from 8 o'clock to 3:30. So get out a little earlier. So that's information's there. And also just want to emphasize, but just, you know, call your attention that Tueri graduated from her teacher training. And it's kind of interesting there's lots of teacher trainings out there with meditation, but just to hold the one she went through is a 4-year process. And it's really becoming, as she's recognized as a teacher, like on the same kind of lineages as Rodney and as Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg and Jack Kornfield. So it's really the highest level of teaching endorsement that is offered by this lineage, by this tradition. And so it's a really significant milestone that she's of course been a teacher for many years, but now she's recognized in this really high level of teaching peer. So we're very lucky to have her have gone through that. And along those lines, that's part of this deep lineage that goes back 2,600 years. And part of that is teacher support, that, you know, we as teachers offer our teachings freely without any expectation of how much is received back. And yet at the same time, we're dependent upon it. We're dependent upon your generosity. And somehow this process has worked for 2,600 years. That teachings were offered freely and people gave in a free way. So I encourage you to support Tuareg, to support the teachers, and with your generosity. So thank you for your time and your flexibility for the change of teaching seats tonight at the last minute. And I am sure you'll enjoy the rest of this month's exploration on death and dying. And I'll see you next month for emotions.